Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. In 1943, Lessing J. Rosenwald gifted roughly 6,000 works on paper to the nascent National Gallery of Art. By the time of his death in 1979, his collection had grown to over 28,000, including nearly 2,400 early modern portrait prints representing Europe's major leaders, artists, and thinkers. On November 25, 2019, as part of the Works in Progress series at the National Gallery of Art, Laura Langer looks at several examples from the Rosenwald collection while discussing the history of collecting portrait prints and their importance in the development of portraiture.
The recent inventory and rehousing of the early modern portrait print collection at the National Gallery of Art have provided a welcome opportunity to revisit and summarize its holdings, particularly for those who are not familiar with it. The portrait prints, roughly 2,400, are part of a massive collection of Lessing J. Rosenwald, who in 1943 donated the prints to the then nascent National Gallery of Art. Rosenwald had the privilege of dedicating his career to cultivating his passion for works on paper. The National Gallery and the Library of Congress became the first, became the major beneficiaries of Rosenwald's efforts, the gallery having been bequeathed more than 28,000 works by the time of Lessing's death in June 1979. Rosenwald's collection was inclusive in its scope. The chronology of his art objects spanned mainly Europe and North America from the late medieval and early modern period to the 20th century. While aspects of Rosenwald's collection have been studied, less attention has been given to this group of 2,400 portrait prints. The prints, mostly engravings, some of which consist of 19th century facsimiles, depict England's royal leaders, important political and cultural figures, with some other notables from the continent. Rosenwald was persuaded to acquire this collection by his good friend, the esteemed art historian Arthur M. Hine, longtime keeper of prints and drawings at the British Museum. Hine convinced Rosenwald that the collective value of prints was important for the field. It was Hine who discovered a group of prints being auctioned at Sotheby's in 1948 from the Herman Marx collection, itself consisting of a large group purchased in 1942, also at Sotheby's from the estate of W.B. Dukes. Hine was embarking on a new project during his retirement years, the multi-volume text Engraving in England in the 16th and 17th Centuries, published in Cambridge between 1952 and 1955. After Rosenwald agreed to purchase the prints, Hine temporarily housed them for his research. Once he completed his work, the prints were sent to America to Rosenwald's Alverthorpe Gallery in Jamestown, Pennsylvania, after which Rosenwald promptly forwarded them to the National Gallery. In his memoir, written 3 years before his death, Rosenwald expressed little interest in Hine's prints. He states, quote, "It so happened at this time that two very large collections of the type of engraved portraits which he needed came up at auction in London. Mr. Hine wrote to me about them and recommended them. I was not the least interested in this type of print, but I purchased them nevertheless." Quote. This is an interesting comment from a man who dedicated his life to building one of the greatest American collections of works on paper. Rosenwald's reticence begs the question, why was he so uninterested in the prints his friend and esteemed print historian recommended? Perhaps Rosenwald was not immediately attracted to the idea of obtaining a bulk purchase of historical prints because of its seemingly obsessive characteristic of retaining quantity over quality. Yet Rosenwald did enjoy some portrait prints. His collection had already consisted of many masterful examples, notably his unparalleled collection of works by the 17th century French artist Robert Nontal. In fact, the French artist, the engraver to King Louis XIV, popularized the common motif of encircling the portrait of the sitter in an oval-shaped frame and setting it on a ledge or altar. Rosenwald had portrait prints by a variety of artists in addition to Nontal. One glorious example is Albrecht Dürer's silver point study for his brother Hans, executed around 1510. Many of these celebrated portrait works were part of Rosenwald's original gift to the National Gallery. Rosenwald's acquisition of the group of portrait prints with his hesitation brings up other intriguing questions of how art is valued both in the economic and historical sense. What value would such an assemblage of, quote, minor works offer on the use and dissemination of prints? How can we distinguish these kinds of works from the disparate glorious ones we've just seen from its collection? Rosenwald's collection of both unique and precious portraits and the large groups, in fact, follow a long tradition of collecting engraved portraits by popular in 17th century in England. It is also helpful to note that the collecting of engravings, as well as other objets d'art, as a practice, had been discussed by writers like Samuel Quetschelberg, whose 1565 text, Inscriptioni, Sveltituli, Teatra, Amplissimi, is the earliest known instructional text on how to organize and store collections of curiosities in what we today consider museums. On engravings, Quetschelberg states, quote, "The small bundles and materials of this foundation," meaning engravings, "are constantly increased through the more industrious of its patrons in such a way that it seems possible to acquire knowledge of the greatest number of disciplines from these images alone. For sometimes, the simple examination of any picture stands out in the memory more than extended reading of many pages," unquote. As the understanding of the institutional practice of collecting engravings developed in Europe, print sellers in England often presented bound portfolios of portrait prints accompanied with biographical text. Two popular examples here are collections of historical biographies by the 17th century publisher Henry Holland, who developed these two in 1618 and 1620. Some impressions from these particular texts are in the portrait groups Rosenwald acquired for Arthur Hein. In addition to multiple singular impressions, for example, there are more than 100 of Francis Bacon in the collection depicting the statesman from his youth to his funerary effigy, almost as many of Elizabeth I, and multiples of other European leaders and British royals, including James I and Ferdinand V of Bohemia. Some prints have texts on the verso indicating that they were cut from publications like the ones previously mentioned. Multiple prints of the same sitters can also show a range of artists to compare. The most common names among Rosenwald's collection include such notable printmakers like Francis Delarome, Thomas Cross, William Faithorne, and over 400 attributed to members of the Dutch printmaking family Van de Passe. In sum, roughly 320 artists' names have been noted in the collection, with over 500 listed as anonymous or in the style of. We can trace some of the provenance of Rosenwald's prints by examining the collector marks on the back of the engravings. As the Rosenwald portraits are made up of both the Marx and Duke's collections, these two collections themselves were formed from other earlier notable collectors spanning multiple centuries. Some include the well-known 19th century collector Sir Mark Masterton Sykes, William Salt, Reverend John Burley James, and Alfred Morrison are the part. These group were the most common that I found on the backs of the prints. And then there were some notable 18th century collectors like Pierre Mariette from the Mariette family and Charles Lenormand du Coudray. Throughout the rehousing process, several unknown collector marks were uncovered, one of the many intriguing attributes of studying works on paper. It can be difficult to assess what is a collector's mark and what is just a smudge or a swig of a pen or pencil, but for the most part, they are clearly discernible. As several of the prints in the Rosenwald group were duplicates, even later 19th century facsimiles, some prints show other echoes of past owners, as evidenced by the various examples of graffiti found on the versos. But these kinds of investigations take time and patience to answer. Please note on the image on the right, the owl mark on the left is the collector mark of Herman Marx, and the one on the right in the circle is the shield of W.B. Dukes. And those were pretty much on almost all of the prints. The versos can be quite entertaining to look at. See this example of someone's efforts to work on their signature. And then on the one on the right, someone trying to perhaps create a fanciful collector mark, but giving up and leaving decorative wiggly lines instead. The benefit of sifting through engraving collections is the chance to learn more about the artists, the manuscripts the prints were intended for, the practice of collecting, and the sitters of such prints. There are many avenues to explore and new analyses to generate. In one case, I focused on one of England's most controversial political figures from the 17th century, Thomas Wentworth, 1st Earl of Strafford, who was executed on 12th of May, 1641. Two of these prints, by the early 18th century French engraver Charles-Louis Simenon, illustrate Wentworth in armor in a roundel frame resting on an altar or tomb, at the bottom of which is an axe with the earl's decapitated head, partially exposed, enveloped by fabric. This conflation of memorial tropes typical of funerary monuments like Memento Mori, which would be the severed head, with portraiture implies a specificity of subject that only market prints could convey, allowing us to reconsider prints as intermediaries of information and how codes of memorialization of the elite like Wentworth were challenged in print production. The Simenon print is an impression of the original included among the 66 engravings featured in Isaac de Lary's four-volume opus, The History of England, Scotland, and Ireland, produced in Rotterdam between 1697 and 1713. The Dutch artists, Adrian van der Werf and his brother Pieter, executed grisaille oil paintings of the portraits to be reproduced by Dutch and French engravers, the latter mainly responsible for the fourth volume, of which Simenon executed three prints, Wentworth, Henriette Marie, wife of Charles I, and George Villiers, the Duke of Buckingham. The National Gallery owns a set of the de Lary volumes, as well as a separate bound folio of the impressions of the portraits. And I'll just pause here quickly to let you know that two of these volumes are on view just outside the doors. You walk by them when you came in. And I do encourage you, please, to look at them after the talk because they are rare and not regularly on view. So it's really great the library took them out for us. Wentworth's portrait is based on a painting made after Sir Anthony Van Dyck, who had produced several portraits of the Earl while at the court of Charles I in the late 1630s. This portrait portrays Wentworth in three-quarter length bust wearing a suit of armor, his head turned towards the viewer with his right hand reaching out across the horizontal plane of the composition. Variations of extant Wentworth portrait prints presents the sitter either with a slender frame and soft features or a more robust one with wide-set eyes and a bulbous nose. Simenon's print exhibits a stoic figure with a steadfast expression, which is a bit different from Van Dyck's stern and formidable Wentworth, or the more tentative one seen in another National Gallery print by Johann Reinhold Schildknecht. Simenon's Wentworth portrait follows the traditional practice of engraved portraiture developed, as mentioned earlier, since the early 17th century by the French portraitist Robert Nantois, who had undoubtedly referenced elements of the aristocratic wall tomb, a type made popular in Florence in the 15th century, of which later iterations exhibited common features of a roundel portrait relief, usually of the Virgin Mary and Christ child, a tomb front or altar mount, ornamental relief work, and an epitaph. Adrian van der Werf's grisaille portraits for the de Lary volumes, however, deviated from convention, with the addition of inventive iconography and elaborate ornamentation, utilizes devices that reference biographical details of the sitter. In the case of Wentworth, items from his execution, the axe and his severed head enveloped by fabric, the fabric being a common reference to a funerary shroud, fill the central foreground. Each of the van der Werf designs showcases an array of illusionistic effects, whether folds of fabric, hanging tapestries, or cherubic angels supporting a portrait's frame. The grisaille models offer a roadmap for the engravers to interpret van der Werf's preference for deep shadows and illusionistic effects, as seen, for example, on the left, in both really, but just to show you on the left, the portrait of Catherine of Aragon presents her in a roundel frame suspended by rope held by two putti leaning over a parapet. Throughout his career, Adrian turned to the grisaille technique, such as this painting of Diana Endymion made around 1705 for the garden room in his home in Rotterdam. Van der Werf's familiarity with indicating depth and modulations of form via the medium of grisaille celebrated the muted color scales recognized in engraved prints. The use of grisaille became an effective method to refine van der Werf's skills in printmaking. His approach thus indicates an intriguing confluence of painting, print, and portraiture. While most of the prints in Delary's volumes note on the lower left as being painted or executed, created by Adrian van der Werf, and the name of the printer who did the engraving on the lower right, the Wentworth print shows only the van der Werf name, so it could reference either Pieter or perhaps both as a collaboration of the creating the composition, but nevertheless suggests the existence of a complex practice of developing engraving that was being cultivated in the van der Werf studio. In the background, at the lower left of the Wentworth portrait roundel, is a chaotic scene of a fire with smoke billowing above equestrian soldiers waving swords as they hover over a body lying prone on the ground. The scene, perhaps to emphasize the sitter dressed in a suit of armor, could allude to Wentworth's detractors' claims that he had instigated war between England and Scotland, an accusation that helped lead to his arrest. The battle image is similar to another Wentworth portrait print by the French engraver Balthazar Moncornot, also at the National Gallery's Rosenwald collection. This one is a 19th century facsimile, however, whose version includes more cavalry figures and infantrymen in the background, and is likely a source of reference for the van der Werf composition. This image of destruction is effectively a visual counterpoint to the decapitated head directly below in the Wentworth portrait. The relatively simplified composition of Wentworth's print places the Earl's violent demise on Tower Hill as a paramount narrative of his political life. A royal critic at first, Wentworth eventually showed sympathies towards Charles I and developed a trusting dynamic with the king, who had bestowed on Wentworth several titles, including Lord Deputy of Ireland in 1632 and Earl of Strafford. Wentworth's reputation as a leader with an iron fist brought him criticism, the accusation of treason, which eventually led to the enactment of a Bill of Attainder, allowing his opponents to convict him with the reluctant support of the king. During the two trials that transpired, multiple publications and prints recorded commentaries on the events. One example, a well-known one from Haller's 1641 engraving of the execution, which is also in the National Gallery's collection. The composition's emphasis on the demise of Wentworth establishes the decapitated head in the lower foreground as its focal point. Furthermore, Simenon's execution of the print reveals a deft hand that has mastered control over the line across the copper plate. Darkened parallel hatches creating a shadowy effect on the head and axe are in contrast with the lighter hatching marks on Wentworth's bust. Details of chips in the roundel frame and altar front add weight to the fractured public career of the sitter. These imperfections also allude to the beginning of a memorial in decay. There are a few other recognized traditional features of an aristocrat's tomb, mainly the bier and effigy, epitaph, or allegorical figures. The inclusion of framed portraits of the deceased hung either on an obelisk or pyramid-shaped monument surrounded by personal attributes, were components that became prevalent on tombs in the 18th century. For example, as we see here on the left, the tomb of Prince Taddeo Barberini at Santa Rosalia in Palestrina, completed in 1704, and the tombs of Cardinal Fabrizio Paolucci at San Marcello al Corso, and Cardinal Leopoldo Calcanini at Sant'Andrea del Frate, both in Rome, completed in the mid-18th century. Such similarities could indicate a connection between the shift in presentation of portraits in print and funerary monuments. Moreover, the head of Wentworth functions as the memento mori, taking the place of the more typical personification of virtues evident on wall monuments from the 15th to the 17th centuries, or the figure of death made popular by Gian Lorenzo Bernini and his innovative monument for Pope Alexander VII at St. Peter's, completed in 1678. Thus, the group of Delary prints reveals the ways in which printmakers reconceptualize portraits via the lens of funerary art. Although van der Werf's design of the Wentworth portrait was executed decades after the Earl's death in 1641, elements of the composition come from earlier depictions of the sitter, albeit with different visual signifiers. While Van Dyck presented Wentworth as one among the aristocracy, regal in armor or in stately attire, those who opposed Strafford often ensconced him in humiliating and scathing imagery, as seen here in an anonymous print from 1646, executed five years after Wentworth's death, depicting his bodiless head being buffeted by waves. And there's a gun here that's probably his hand. It's hard to tell. So along with the other royalist supporters of Charles I and Charles I himself, above them is the ark representing the Commonwealth and the Assembly of Divines, and above that is the portraits of those considered to be defenders of the Union. In the case of Wentworth and its political controversies, the dissemination of portrait prints can teach us much about the power images held during the early modern period. The various kinds of portraits of the Earl ultimately became enmeshed in the visual propaganda of his time. While the memorializing image executed by Simoneau done after his death could be regarded both as a testament to either his martyrdom or his demise, it nevertheless represents the kinds of networks of draftsmen and printmakers who shared imagery, as evidenced by van der Werf's reliance on Van Dyck's paintings and his knowledge of other portrait prints, such as those by Montcornet. This case study of Wentworth print in the Rosenwald group is another reminder also of the kinds of information we can glean from such bulk collections of prints. There are many other connections to be found. This is not to say that these impressions of Delary's prints do not survive in other collections. The Wentworth one, for example, can be found at the British Museum and the New York Public Library. Another indicator of the multiplicity of the prints is itself an important quality as much as the preciousness of a singular object. The valuation of the Rosenwald print group thus raises imperative questions. When does quantity become as good as quality? Once these prints are taken out of their collective identity, do they cease to be relevant? These are the kinds of existential questions I leave for you. I don't necessarily have an answer. Yet it's an intriguing paradox to consider in light of the nature of prints. They can embody both the specificity of a unique thing or an economic tool duplicated for mass audiences. The celebrated early modern print and drawings curator at the British Museum, Anthony Griffiths, made a salient point about the mass market print. He says, quote, "The fate of minor prints, the mass market works produced in enormous numbers to be used rather than to be collected. The cheap ones are a different matter. It is vitally important to remember what survives is what collectors put into their albums. Those historians who wish to write about the print as a commodity for mass market and international trade have a real problem. Their material has more or less entirely disappeared," end quote. It is the case that the survival of the more quotidian examples of prints are far fewer than the heralded ones placed in the realm of works of art. And yet mass market prints serve a critical role in providing knowledge of the use, significance, and transmission of the past cultural norms and ideologies. Bulk collecting like that of Rosenwald, Marx, and Dukes, and others have in fact preserved a small element of the more mass-produced works. Of course, what is considered mass-produced needs to be defined as well. The number of copies of the Delary volumes were far less than what was published in broadsides. Therefore, our understanding of the profusion and appropriation of portrait prints remains incomplete. However, the National Gallery's collection teaches us that we have an opportunity to take advantage of a resource that is not often readily available for study. With that, I encourage you to make appointments to view the prints in the two wonderful study rooms that are here, one dedicated to American art and the other for everything else, essentially. Please also take advantage of the online search engine. There you'll find more cataloging information of any of these works of art discussed here and much more. Thank you very much.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.